Welcome to the story of Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop. This is Chapter 14, Into the Maelstrom. It was kind of crazy after Millie left school in the middle of the day. It's even crazier when the shop just shuts off. I'm the author, Ray DeBicke, happy to read this story to you. The shop reacts too well to Millie, right? Right? You can join Millie Salmon on Patreon or find more at milliesalmon.com. And you can follow this podcast and other stories on social media at Infinite Shop Limited. Chapter 14, Into the Maelstrom. They caught Reggie and his dad, Mort Tarrasque, in the crowd streaming out of school. Reggie told Jules and Stoney as much of the story as he could, gently emphasizing his hand in the successful overthrow of a tyrannical regime. Mort rolled his eyes, but didn't have any records of detention to back up anger. "Reggie," Jules asked, "please do not take offense at this. What prompted Millie to actually leave school?"
"She just did it on her own. I mean, the hawk took her drawing book. That was enough to get Millie raging mad and headed down the hall. But she didn't look back. Didn't talk to anybody or anything."
"Why would she leave?" Jules asked the heir as much as anyone. Stoney knew the answer without having any extra explanation. "Because things got out of hand. She locked into a path and couldn't turn back."
"Oh, don't worry about that," Reggie said. "She's got pardons from the governor. I made sure she can come back."
Jules' expression went through several phases, landing on simply asking what that meant, but Stoney decided to cut the conversation short.
"You have done so well, Reggie." She patted him on the shoulder. "You're truly a legend."
She turned to his father.
"We have to find Millie, so I can't stay. You're raising a good one here, Mort. If you want to go get him a boba tea, I'll pay you back with drinks next time we get together."
Mort's opinion of the situation turned at that moment, seeing that this generally well-assembled and on-top-of-things parent was recognizing his own quality parenting.
"That sounds like a good idea, Stoney. I will do that. And let me know when you want to get together."
Stoney's recognition provided Reggie with just about every desire he had in life.
"Thank you,"
he almost got out in a whisper. Plus, there would be boba. Jules and Stoney walked away, and it occurred to Jules that he could call Grandpa and let him know what was happening. Jules took out the second cell phone, the very not local one, and dialed. Then he tapped on it. Then he stopped and tapped on it again. The action was so irregular, Stoney stopped and looked at her phone.
"No coverage."
"Mine neither."
They simultaneously broke into a run towards the shop, knowing what they would find, or more specifically, what they would not find. Grandpa came back to the shop, its door in the shiny opal building on Dalabrator. Mrs. Pitters was sitting on a bench a few feet away from the door. She was impeccably arranged and perfectly symmetrical, with both hands on her cane, and her long jacket extended just so in both directions, framing her round self.
"Mrs. Pitters, where is everyone? Where is Millie?"
"I don't know, Master Pilling, and that bothers me,"
she explained, fulfilling her steps of the surprise, bringing Millie into the shop, then as much as she could hear from her end, which was just the soft click of the door and nothing else. She had attempted to open the door after it closed behind her, but it was locked.
"It seemed like a mean trick to play on an old woman, so I stopped thinking of it as a trick, but I can't arrive at what happened."
Grandpa looked at the door. He ran his hand around the threshold until he felt a whirring noise, or should have felt a whirring noise. He looked both directions down the street before taking a device out of his pocket. It was a little bigger than an ordinary cell phone with a large screen. He put it against the threshold.
"The shop is off."
"Off to where?"
off, as in turned off.
Where does it go when it's turned off?
Supposedly here.
He tried the doorknob again. This isn't just locked. I can't feel the buzz. It's fully detached. Let's hope that Jules is trying something from the other end.
Grandpa backed away from the door. Mrs. Pitters patted the space on the bench next to herself and held out the open end of a wrapped pack of cookies. Grandpa sat down and took one.
What is something he would be trying? Mrs. Pitters asked.
At this point, perhaps something is more along the lines of, well, anything.
He chewed his cookie. Firth was a pretty smart guy. He was particularly smart for a boy on his planet of Tosker, even smarter than some of the girls. For this, he credited his mother. She never held him back or told him that he was limited to the normal boy jobs like the open field work or keeping the house. Mom never made his father feel bad about his own choices to stay home and raise the kids, but she wanted options to be open for her sons. She would take Firth and his younger brother Claude out of the city on important nights, letting them set up a tent on the floor of the mountain telescope. She would spend time inside the tent, then excuse herself to align the machine for the next round of images. They'd occupy themselves with the finger pit game or poring over a comic book. Then she would come back into the tent and read silly stories or split packs of cakes. It was with them in the tent on the floor that she found the comet that bore her son's names. The boys loved the fun and silly stuff, but Firth was waiting until later. Claude would fall asleep and start snoring away curled up in the bottom of his sleeping bag. Only then, it would be just Firth sitting next to Mom at the terminal watching some of the initial pictures the telescope was taking and beaming into the computer. Only there would Mom start talking, actually talking, about the stars. Like few who looked through a telescope as work, she maintained a poetic view of the practice. She was a historian reading books that had never been in print until now and would never be again unless delicately preserved in these careful notes and intricate pictures. Only when it was just him and Mom did Firth start to understand that he was seeing written the first and only illuminated manuscript of the universe. This page could only be made on this night right here, and she was letting Firth join in. All of time was captured in those images from the beginning of the universe to the present. The dim stars in the background had sent their light out millions of years before. The light picked up cosmic companions as they passed newer places, young fiery stars born well after the source of passing light had burned out. The companion photons grazed by countless civilizations that might still be there or may not. Now, the ancient light fell silently on this lens on this night so that Firth and his mother could record everything it had to say. In this picture was life and death. It was dazzling, immense, and terrifying, or it would be scary, but he was here with Mom. He would not have felt as secure in the universe if it wasn't his mother hearing all his complex thoughts and returning them in a voice matching his awe and surprise and joy. It was her everlasting curiosity that really got him. Where some would see the infinite and be shocked, Firth only heard his mother's passion to understand more. Soon his voice would fill with these same feelings when he described the cosmos. So being a smarter person, Firth thought about a lot of things. He thought about the long treks the shop took across the universe, all in an instant. He thought about the incredibly strange tacklos or fabbers he had met, and how they seemed perfectly normal after they started asking for a new book or a particular album. The persistence engine helped with that, being able to translate. but it never needed translation that people were people, and all of them wanted feelings raised by music or words. They might have a stalk of antennae growing out of their foreheads or a hard exoskeleton, but stories are universal. Recently, Firth's thoughts had turned from the long past of stars to the future, his future. He would be entering university in the fall, pursuing the same astronomy his mom had introduced him to on the early days of joining her at the telescope. And, creeping just a little into the edges of his thoughts, he wondered who would join him on those long nights at the telescope, and who might share talking about the universe with awe, surprise, and joy that he now had. It was a wandering wonder that filled his middle vision as he spent long afternoons behind the counter at the shop. This was not a long afternoon. This was a very truncated afternoon. And, very suddenly, it wasn't the universal past or daydreamy future that needed Firth's attention. It was a very quiet present that pulled him from his thoughts about future's past and past-filled future. He needed to turn his significant intellect towards the present problem, this shop with the dimmed lights and strangely out-of-place quiet, and this birthday girl who would not be making it to her party without some help. Firth sat on his stool behind the counter. Millie pulled up the extra stool on the other side and sat there. Stood, actually, on the first rung, so she could read upside down the binder that Firth had pulled from under the counter. This was not the massive date book or the tiny schedule book. Behind a cover labeled Procedures, there were dividers in Grandpa's handwriting with little tabs labeled Hall Breach, Out of State Checks, and Literary Critics. This was a reasonable size clutch of pages, something that could be carried to math class in a regular backpack. Millie shuddered at the thought of math class, Mrs. Hawkins, and her not being at school for much of the day. A shock of memory of just a few hours ago surged through her, leaving behind a hollow pool of whether she had done something terrible. She rubbed her eyes with her fists and whispered along, "No." "You okay?" Firth asked. "Weird day," Millie paused. "Birthdays, am I right?" Firth felt like something was going unsaid, but if it were brought up, he might be in the torrent of a much larger problem than a listless magic bookstore floating in the void. So he decided to play it safe and share a little of his own life. "Our birthdays seem to operate a little differently than yours. Would you like me to tell you about them? Short version?" Millie could not say exactly what she wanted at that moment, so somewhat startled by the softness of the question. She looked at Firth with his slim cheeks and artistically spastic dark hair. "You do birthdays differently?" "Our families are licensed for children at certain times of the year. You want bakeries and party places to have businesses all year, right? So everyone in my family was born in Tuftis. I think that's like kind of your springtime when everything's blooming. Good excuse to go outside and have a cake. But we get one big one because it's a celebration for everyone." "But no one is recognizing your birthday and the day you were born." Millie felt irritated on Firth's behalf. He didn't need it. "You get a party with all your favorite people," Firth replied. Millie's eyes dropped back to the binder. He looked at the top of her head as she stared intently at the upside-down book on the counter. "You didn't have a lot of your favorite people around most of the day, did you?" "The drawing pad, the bus, the walkout." "No, not really." "I'm sorry, Millie. And now you're stuck with some alien weirdo telling you about customs on a faraway world while the shop you're in is floating in space. We'll get you back to the folks you like."
"Thanks, Firth." Millie gave a little sniff. "I think you're working your way up that list."
They both turned back to the book. After a long, but not uncomfortable, few minutes, Firth observed, "I don't see a tab or listing for the shop is turned off."
Are you sure it's off?
He opened the sliding cabinet between the cubbies and the community bulletin board. There were some electronics and indicator lights that stubbornly refused to indicate anything. Normally, there's at least a little green or yellow going on up here, Firth said. None of these are on.
Let's go to the machine room.
Firth did not want to consider this. For him, that room was the absolute last case scenario.
I think, he started, we can see if the request system is working and find out if there's some book about how to fix the shop.
I don't think that's going to work.
Well, that's the next thing we usually try.
Maybe, but what comes after that? Millie asked. You've tried opening the door and all the binders, and now we work down all the books? Are we going to start seeing if there's a secret panel?
She looked at the non-indicating indicator lights behind a display she never knew existed.
Check that one off. While you wait for the book, can I get a jump on wiggling a whole bunch of wires to see if a connection is loose?
Firth was avoiding answering her. He had been thinking about doing several of those things in that order.
I see your point, but give me one more chance, he said.
From under the counter slid a keyboard, a part of the countertop lit with a display. It was the screen they used to try and find the lost march.
Firth started typing.
He typed again and again. Nothing appeared on the screen for a long time until a little box popped up saying, "No connection." The letters were innocuous, but the meaning was infuriating. Millie didn't need to say anything, but she did anyway.
Okay, let's go to the machine room now.
Firth's placid demeanor broke. His voice was still soft, but it carried the hint of upset.
Look, I know your grandpa's actual grandchild. I know how important your parents are to this shop. There are still things that we simply are not supposed to do.
For the second time today, Millie felt she had been incorrectly corrected. You didn't take her drawing book. That had sent her reeling out of school and down the road for hours. Was this some punishment her parents were administering? Had they found out she left school and locked her in the shop with this Firth character? Or was it an elaborate plan formulated by the shop itself, punishing her for something she shouldn't be doing? She had a moment of something for this Firth. He had been so wonderful at Brentone, and he had her on the edge of calm just a second ago. Now he was just another tall person, not even an adult, a teenager, telling her that she could or could not do something. She knew the math at school, but it just had to be Mrs. Hawkins' math without a drawing pad. Now they were in this problem, this disconnected place, and Firth was not allowing them to do the one thing that could unlock the problem they were facing. It just had to be Firth's solutions without the machine room. He was blocking her retreat. So for the second time that day, Millie grabbed her drawing book, stormed out of a room, and through a door she was forbidden from going through. Firth followed her up the stairs, huffing his objections, even after Millie opened the door to the machine room and stopped in her tracks. When he realized she stopped moving and was not listening at all, Firth shut up too and looked in.
I imagine that this is really bad, Millie said.
Bad is probably not how bad this actually is, Firth unhelpfully observed. The room was empty.
Grandpa sat perfectly symmetrically next to the perfectly symmetrical Mrs. Pitters on the bench near the door of the shop on Dollopertour. Beside each other, they were not perfectly symmetrical, with the very round Mrs. Pitters and the whip-thin Grandpa. They had been talking through possible solutions for an hour now.
I mean, Grandpa pondered, since Jules launched the shop from Homeworld,
It really has existed off any single planet at all times.
Couldn't we just wait until someone on Homeworld tries to walk into the shop?
That might not even work. I think it would be possible if the original door opened, calling the shop back to its original position, but we don't have a connection to that door anymore. I think it's a noodle restaurant now.
Mrs. Pitters upset her symmetry and looked at Grandpa.
I didn't realize that. You haven't been home in all these years?
Oh, no, no, that's not an issue. Grandpa laughed a little. That neighborhood was a dump, and we just happened to have the shop there because rent was affordable. It was just a store of some Homeworld music and a few graphic novels by local folks. Once Jules came up with the persistence engine, we were happy to be out of there. I still get to visit Homeworld fairly often when regular customers come through a much nicer door, and that's plenty.
So, can we get a message to a place that the shop may open?
Mrs. Pitters asked.
Neither Earth nor Tosker are connected, and those are the only places the shop will go with Millie and Firth opening the door.
He thought for a second.
Well, maybe here, as that was what happened the last time Millie was in the shop by herself.
Your granddaughter directs the shop to alternative locations.
We're not going to consider that for a moment. Firth would hopefully not allow her to force open the front door if they don't have a connection.
Grandpa rubbed his eyes with both fists.
I'm sure he knows that.
So we have come to the same conclusion again. It is a good time to wait.
Mrs. Pitters rested her hands on her cane. Grandpa sighed. They stared at the door some more. Firth and Millie stepped into the empty machine room. It was, without all the running simulations and information flying around, a fairly tight fit. When Millie was in the car garage of Dad's imagination, the room felt like it could hold a couple of buses. This was maybe an unadorned closet, with greenish fabric textured walls, a single light above. If the light was a dangling bulb with a pull chain, it wouldn't have felt totally out of place, but it was an illuminated panel in the ceiling. The room smelled of static electricity or copier.
Where did the car go?
Millie knew the answer, but felt the need to ask the question out loud. The car was never actually there.
The machine room is definitely off, Firth said, unsure if anything was really definite at this point.
He didn't have a lot left to imagine, but kept talking because it felt correct.
The room is only a representation, the operator's understanding of what the machine is projecting.
But it's only information, Millie interjected. The information is still somewhere. The machine is looking at it. We're just not seeing it from this room.
Because the machine is off.
That's not right. The machine and the information exist together. There's still power coming into the machine from a lot of different corners. The persistence engine might be off, but the whole machine can't be all the way off. Do you speak English?
Firth got the implication immediately that something in the shop was still translating Millie's home language to Firth's home language of Grinky. Firth had to laugh a little at the question.
He heard it, or the machine printed in his brain, the question as, "Do you understand common words?"
Something he was asked by a particularly rude customer one time. Essentially, are you too dumb to even know basic language? A customer actually asked that in this shop in their own language to Firth, who was from half the galaxy away. It made Firth take a step back in his brain.
Nope, I get it. But how do we wake this beast up?
He stomped. The floor was a tighter woven green, like the walls, but no sponginess. The walls absorbed the sound recoil, a perfect non-echo.
Wake up, computer, he yelled.
also a non-echo. That's not right either, Millie thought aloud. She felt Firth had the right idea, but... Firth, I think you're on to something. She said it like her mother would have, offering something to get buy-in for something bigger. But there is an order to waking up the machine. It can't just turn on all the way at once. Little pieces have to start turning before the big pieces do. That sounds reasonable, but how? I have an idea. But first, why did you laugh? Millie asked. Just now, why did you laugh?
I was irritated at you and suddenly got unirritated fast. That back and forth tickles.
Me? Why were you irritated at me?
Yes, you, and yes, I was irritated. You're young and pushy, and you have every right to be because you're also right. Your questions weren't translated easily into my ears. It's a problem I remember having coming into the job as acolyte. I hope you know that when I say I get it, that I understand what you're going through in a lot of ways.
Oh.
Millie wasn't quite sure she knew what she was going through one way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now how do we get this thing started?
I think it can hear us, but we have to let the machine know that we're talking to it rather than through it.
She put her drawing book on the floor next to her feet and stood up straight.
I'm going to try and talk the machine room back into controlling things.
Well, if anyone can do that, it's probably you. I'll give you the room.
Don't go too far.
Millie smiled at Firth.
Please.
Firth stopped, backing up, and leaned on the door frame. Millie had a card up her sleeve that she didn't tell Firth about. Literally up her sleeve was her charm bracelet. On it were the handful of beads she wired to look like charms, but acted like the small machines she read about in books from other worlds. There was the bead that looked like a cross-sected black pear, but did the hard work to connect the shop printer heads to the duck pond. Those extra old phones were just organ donors sacrificed to answer Dad's questions. There was the orange bead with a small, imperfect black dot that she wired with a coiled antenna that wildly increased the download speed on cell phones for her and Reggie and Pat's. And there was the perfect sky blue sphere that she added just before being able to open the door the wrong way into the darkness when the Lost March disappeared. She added another wired bead over Christmas, a ruby red arch that she was pretty sure connected directly to the machine room. She flipped it into her palm and pushed the button.
Computer, turn on.
The non-start was deafening. A little disappointed, Millie tried some of the regular computer call commands.
Computer, machine. Hey, computer. Good morning, computer.
The echoless walls remained green and unimpressed. She tried a few more.
On, computer. Wake up. Arch. I am Millie Salmon and I want you to turn on.
She stopped for a second. Did this machine recognize her as Millie Salmon? If she was going to throw all her effort at restarting this machine, she should use all of her effort. She folded her hands, took a deep breath, and pushed down the intercom button of the red bead one more time. In a firm voice, she projected into the green closet.
I am Millennium Salvia Montaigne, and you are going to show me the universe.
Millie's voice was picked up by the hidden microphone in her bracelet, bypassing the running translator programs in the shop, and landing at the foot of a very confused and only half-aware control program. It shuffled the authentication request to a cluster of security programs
that were yelling at each other because they were sectioned off and didn't have anything else to do. The job passed them by and fell to a rarely used identifier subroutine in the small recesses of the persistence engine, a bit of code that only got direct requests from Grandpa, Stony, or Jules. It had to brush off a never-before-combined authenticator. Millie was right. It wouldn't have recognized her daily name. From there, a tiny blip of, "It's okay, she's allowed and she's important," pulsed back up the chain of programs to the overloaded control program. Since this pulse took priority channel, it caught the control program's direct attention. The program understood the order as permission to drop the screaming red alert sirens that had cascaded into withdrawing all tethers, sending the shop into standby mode. The machine room recognized Millie's authority. Millie saw a flicker. It flickered across, then down, then appeared as a floating question mark, head height, and about halfway between her and the wall. "I think you have its attention," Firth said. "I think I do." She reached out and touched the hovering punctuation. "Please show me the status of the persistence engine."
The room exploded in light.
Firth fell on his butt backwards out the door. Millie shuddered as the universe's information blasted directly into her face from a panicked and irritated control program. It was a fire hose of random bits of data, from the license plate of her parents' car, HUX2202, to a note played by a black hole, a low B flat, to the bank account number of the Janus Limited Family Corporation of the Mining Moon Finistoria, 5104642. Millie was right that the small gears had to turn before the big ones did. Unfortunately, some of those little gears were filters and were now just waking back up. She didn't appreciate the time they were taking to start filtering again, or the chaos they dealt with. Millie got the familiar taste of metal in her mouth and the shaking water in her eyes. She didn't like this feeling, and it was happening yet again today. But this was her birthday, her machine room, her voice unlocked it, and she would not run away now. She held her own hands tighter and started explaining to the computer how this information would be coordinated. The computer continued to respond. Some of the larger gears were moving now. From his rear end, Firth watched Millie speak into the phantom machine sound of information flowing through ephemeral wires of space. Her talk, her conversation with the computer was growing complex, passing the line between telling things to go where and moving into speaking to the data itself. Her words were the thrum of conversation at a crowded restaurant, each bit making sense to those involved, but a mess to anyone trying to absorb everything. It was the opposite of the information coming from the computer, whose entire body could make sense, but the pieces were so fast and random that they could not be pieced together from this perspective. Her words meshed with the cacophony of information that was flowing past, locking into the swirl, and they were making the swirling flood back. What was flashing, brain-melting lights and symbols began toning into a slower strobe, then a light flicker. Millie's voice similarly retracted from a crazed howl into a singularity, then to a pointed instruction for a child, then to an easy chat with a friend. Millie ended her dialogue. The machine ended its fury. Firth looked to see what had been described. Dad's garage was gone. "Where did this place come from?" he asked, standing and brushing himself off. Millie picked up her drawing book. It opened naturally to the newest page, the one that had a dark black streak where her pencil dragged across the book as Mrs. Hawkins pulled it out from under her arm.
She swallowed, a remnant taste of anger from across several points in the day. She flipped a few pages backward. It was her drawing of a billion lights at night in Dalabrator. Searchlights and running tubes of buildings and connecting roads. The night of the Lost March, when she walked Dalen out to the taxi. The machine room was exactly what she had drawn. Firth pulled a tight smile. Well, I'm pretty sure that is the end of my time as acolyte.
What does that mean?
I don't think anyone since your parents has had that kind of control over this place, this shop, this library. My time was finishing anyway, so you seem to have claimed who gets to have this job next. Millie tried to object, if only to find out more about what he was talking about. Don't argue. Just listen. That didn't stop Millie from wanting to talk, but Firth talked over her. Somewhat a surprise, after she just spoke this room from a maelstrom. Your grandfather is one of the greatest people I've ever met. He is a kind teacher. You just have to make sure you listen to the things he says and not the things you think he says.
Mom tells me that about people. I'm starting to understand what it means. I don't know if I'm getting it right.
The acolyte before me told me the same thing, and I hated him for months. I mean, what kind of advice is listen but don't? What the plet talk does that even mean? Plet talk didn't translate, but Millie got the impression it was a very hot place. Millie looked at Firth, trying to place him. He had been a nice enough presence at the shop, kind of a friendly puppy. Then Brentone, when him and Dalen were anchors she didn't know she needed. Then today, he needled, called her mean, told her that she couldn't come to the machine room. Opposite of his dad that she had met at Brentone, who was super giving, Firth seemed like he was holding something back. Since he didn't talk much before today, she couldn't measure if this was how he normally spoke, but she couldn't stop looking at him, and he didn't stop talking. Your grandfather has so much information in his head that he doesn't know when it falls out. All of it is useful, but you have to decide when to apply it. He once told me a story about apple pickers off the coast of Nahagar, stood knee-deep in the honey water for days, one at each tree until a single apple was ripe. They would take that apple into the beach collector and return to their tree until the next apple ripened. They were on contract for 2 straight years. For a decade afterward, and your grandpa emphasized this, no apples. They couldn't eat or smell apples or even look at a cloud without thinking about apples.
That's a ridiculous story.
That's also what I thought. Until I found out that it's absolutely true, and there's more. Half of those apple pickers are accomplished soil engineers. The other half became some of the most important weather scientists that have ever lived. None of those words made sense to me until I started to pick through fields of study for my university. That's when I realized my decision was set between something absolutely new or something I've been doing for years. I could not have picked something that was a little bit here and a little bit there. I had to make a full commitment. Keep staring up at the trees or really embrace looking elsewhere. Once I realized that, I understood his story and where I was headed.
Where are you headed?
University, for astronomy, something I've always loved but really get to commit to. First male in my family to ever go. So listen to everything your grandfather says. It may not be important right now, but it will be important. It all has a connection. It will offer insight. You just have to remember it. Firth was not nearly as tall as his father, but he was still a good bit taller than Millie. He smiled at her, bent down, and kissed her solidly on her forehead. Good luck, Millennium Salvia Montaigne. We have been waiting for you for a long time. He turned and walked downstairs. This stunned and embarrassed Millie. She felt this room was the lens of the universe, and all of creation saw this skinny teenager plant his lips on her forehead like a baby. But she couldn't let go of the first word he said. "We have been waiting." Her questions lingered for only a second in her mind as they heard the door open. The room flickered with information, and Millie understood that they were connected again to Earth. Mom and Dad called upstairs from the shop floor. The room flickered again, and she heard Grandpa and Mrs. Pitters greeting Firth and her parents. Millie closed her drawing book and went downstairs. Before anyone asked any questions, Firth spoke. "Millie single-handedly fixed the shop. I only stood in the way of her doing it faster." They didn't know what to say, so Firth kept talking. "I fundamentally understand the shop, but I cannot do what Millie can do naturally, instinctually, almost intrinsically. I would like her to have my position as acolyte." Dad's expression of shocked pride lowered to a more normal position of salty parenting. "We have a lot to talk about before we get there," Dad said. "We have a lot to talk about from today." Millie took that as a cue for honesty.
"I walked out of school today."
It felt like she was admitting it to Firth, like she hid it from him.
"We know," Mom said. "Hawkins took my book, took it right from under my pencil. I could not fight her. I just ran."
A weird cross of relief and pity ran from one of Dad's cheeks to the other. Jules knew how very important that book was. He and Stoney had made a concerted effort to get Millie to attach to something, and drawing books worked wonderfully. She had a couple for each year of school so far, and more filled from each summer. They went with her everywhere.
"Why did you want to fight?" Mom asked. "It was all very sudden. I don't know. I just wanted to fight everything she was."
Dad made a motion to prepare to go in for a hug, but it was Mom's turn to talk.
"Look, Millie, we're going to have a lot to deal with about this. We are not going to go to your school and yell at your teacher, and you cannot pick when to walk out. It's like everything else. There's rules to this game, and you have to play it according to the ones she's using."
"Even if she's just making them up as she goes along, that's completely unfair. She hasn't had a problem until today. I don't know why today. She sensed I was happy, sensed it was my birthday, so she could come down on me. I'm sorry for choosing today as my birthday."
"We're not," Dad said. "It is still your birthday. We are happy you picked today to celebrate, even if it's not turning out exactly the way we planned. But we still have plans."
"Parts of plans," Mom said, and sent a quick text message.
Within a minute, Dalen showed up at the shop with a quickly melting ice cream cake. This was Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop, Chapter 14, Into the Maelstrom. In the next episode, let's start the final section of the story of Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop. There may be some forces aligning against her. Thank you for listening. You can find more about Millie at milliesalmon.com or join us on Patreon. Please like, subscribe, and leave a review on whichever podcast app you use. Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop is a production of Infinite Shop Limited, which you can follow on all social media platforms. I'm Ray Dubicki. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to reading some more for you soon.